Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, a discussion of one of the topics making news this week. This is KCBS In-Depth.
Silicon Valley is known for producing companies that move fast and break things. But few have moved faster or broken more things than ride-hailing service Uber, a company that's every success was also accompanied by disruption, dislocation, and controversy. I'm Keith Menconi. This is KCBS In-Depth, and today on the program, we're going to be talking about the man largely responsible for shaping Uber's distinctive approach to business, Uber's founder and former CEO, Travis Kalanick. For that, we'll be speaking with New York Times technology reporter Mike Isaac about his new book, Super Pumped: The Battle for Uber. It's a book that draws on hundreds of interviews with current and former Uber employees to tell the story of how Kalanick led Uber through its meteoric rise and about his eventual fall from grace in the face of Uber scandal. Mike Isaac, thanks so much for being on KCBS In-Depth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I mentioned a second ago that Kalanick was responsible for shaping Uber, but I think his reach was really honestly a lot broader than that, because Uber has come to symbolize a lot of the excesses and this very particular Silicon Valley ethos that's sprung up over the last 10 years or so. The move fast and break things, the change as much as you can, think about the consequences later. Yeah. Which way should we think about it, though? Is it the fact that Silicon Valley shaped Travis Kalanick, or is it Travis Kalanick shaped Silicon Valley?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I feel like there's kind of a dynamic that goes both ways here, you know? First of all, like, you're totally right. I think the point of this book is that it's a book on Uber, but it really is much larger than Uber. This company came to just sort of be an avatar for every negative thing you could imagine about Silicon Valley, whether it's like just startling amounts of excess and greed and wealth, or like bad bro behavior, misogyny, and in some cases violence and recklessness.
And just the fact that we know what bad bro behavior, when you say that.
I mean, that's like coined phrase at this
right,
point,
right? Yeah.
No, I think, but I think that there was a cycle of, you know, from the earliest days of the Valley, you know, the people sort of lionized this idea that founders are, let's say, young men in hoodies in their college dorm rooms eating a bowl of ramen, making the next billion-dollar app, right? And that sort of mythology became really attractive. And I think that kind of led to two things. One, I think it's just sort of let unconventional behavior maybe thrive in some cases, you know, whether that was just sort of being kooky or later being more aggressive and no holds barred. And then I think also it kind of fed this idea that founders have this real great authority and kind of can act recklessly and maybe perhaps be more comfortable breaking rules just because you can't disrupt entrenched industries without breaking some eggs or whatever you want to, you know, whatever metaphor you want to say. But I do think Travis Kalanick was probably the Ubermensch of that mentality, right?
So to speak. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Like there's like rule breakers. There's like Zuckerbergs of the world where they kind of push the boundaries, and then there's Travis who just kind of goes all the way.
Right. And that's the image of Travis Kalanick that we have right now, this post-2017, now that we've seen how it all shook out. The version of him that we've all received is really that image that you have of really pushing the boundaries, really leaning into excess as much as possible. But when Uber started back in 2009, that's certainly not how he was thinking of himself. He was thinking of himself as somebody who was taking on an entrenched industry, the taxi industry, and delivering a service that he felt was long overdue.
Yeah, that's totally right. I think from the beginning, I mean, if you can remember back in 2008 or 9 in San Francisco, right? I used to work at Wired, which is at like 3rd and Howard, I think, something like that. And I would have to leave for meetings 45 minutes early just because I didn't know if a cab was going to show up to get me to my next thing,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And like that was the whole thing. Like the taxi industry didn't really even have to to cater to customers or care about whether they would show up or not, just because they have a monopoly on the industry, right? They had a full sort of lock on how people got around town, whether if you weren't using public transportation or didn't have have your own car. And so Travis Kalanick and his co-founders, Garrett Camp and then Ryan Graves, they come in and say, look, there should be a better way of doing this, and we should be the ones to provide it. And this is also, if you can remember back when smartphones were not ubiquitous,
but right.
The iPhone was starting to be on the rise, and like BlackBerry was this sort of proto smartphone, and then the iPhone just sort of unlocked this idea that through an app, through a press of a button, mm-hmm. You could get whatever. And for Travis and them, that meant hailing a car.
Right, right. So they were riding that wave of early opportunities that were opened up by the App Store and all of the sorts of things that you could now do with the App Store. So there's a lot of history to unpack. There was about 10 years that we're talking about in the history of this book, from 2009 when the company started to 2017 when Travis Kalanick fell from grace, left Uber, although with billions of dollars in his pocket. So, you know, not exactly an uber sad story, but certainly probably not the ending that he was hoping for from Uber. Let's skip to the end of that story just so that all of our listeners are on the same page and up to date on what exactly happened. 2017 was an intense year for Uber. Where did that come from, and how did it lead to Travis Kalanick's ouster?
Yeah, so I would say the first, 8 years of Uber's reign, first 7 or 8 years of Uber's reign, was largely popular. I think the company had an aura of, okay, the founder's kind of a jerk. He's very aggressive, whatever, up at the top, willing to sort of take on these entrenched industries. But we like the service so much that we're kind of cool with it, right? Like it's half the price of getting somewhere in a cab if I use an Uber, and I can get it wherever I want, and I can use it basically all times of the day. So 2017 comes around, and it's just sort of like I've never seen scandal after scandal hit a company in such a short amount of time, right? Mm. There's... Travis was taking a lot of heat for being on, if you can remember this sort of Trump Business Council, which in the beginning of 2017, I think people inside of the company as well as around Silicon Valley were starting to grasp some of what the Trump administration was going to do. And that didn't sit well with a lot of people, including that first ban on predominantly Muslim countries traveling to U.S. And so that sort of sparked this movement against Travis, as well as directly after that, Susan Fowler, a former employee of Uber, wrote this memo basically detailing her history of harassment at the company, including by her manager on her like first day of work on mm-hmm. his engineering team. And, you know, after that, you name it, right? It was right. Google suing them or other managers just getting ousted for harassment. And it was just one thing after another that eventually culminated. I would say the biggest part, though, was Travis getting caught on video screaming at a driver, basically, and sort of showed how little he regarded the people who worked for him, you know. Mm-hmm. And then by June 2017, he was pushed out in a very dramatic boardroom coup.
He was pushed out, yeah. All right, well, a lot more history to dig into right there. But before we move on, I want to remind our listeners that this is KCBS In Depth. I'm Keith Menconi. Today on the program, we're going to be talking about the rise and fall of one man who has played an outsized role in shaping how business is done in Silicon Valley. That, once again, is Uber founder Travis Kalanick. Joining us to discuss him is Mike Isaac, author of the new book, Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber. And let's return to, I think, what is the main thing that this sort of examining this history unlocks for us, and that is, how did Silicon Valley turn out the way it is? What are the mm-hmm. characteristics that emerged over the last 10 years, and how did those come about? And I think a good place to get into that would be to talk about Uber's own ethos and mythology of itself, and we get some hint of that in the very title of your book, Super Pumped.
Yeah.
Tell us where Super Pumped comes from and what that says about the company.
Yeah, totally. So it's funny. I think people who first see this book on the stands are like, what is this, right? Like, what is Super Pumped? And
I think a lot of the employees that first heard that phrase had similar thoughts.
Right, exactly. No, that's exactly right. So back in 2015, I want to say, you know, basically, if you think about every tech company in the Valley, they all have these very lofty mission statements and ideals. It's not like most, you know, every company, every corporation has some sort of like corporate speak philosophy, right? But mm-hmm. I think the Facebooks and the Googles of the world are much more high flying and lofty, right? Whether mm-hmm. it's we want to connect the world at Facebook, or we want to organize the world's information at Google, or that we're customer obsessed at Amazon. So Travis Kalanick, who had this real obsession with Amazon and basically wanting Uber to become Amazon, and Amazon has these 14 values that it's espoused to its employees for a very long time, handed on down on high from Jeff Bezos.
Mm.
And so Travis's idea was essentially to remix those 14 values and make it sound a little more like a bro kind of reciting mm-hmm. these things. So some of the best ones were, I think making magic was one, meritocracy, toe stepping, and always be hustling was
always
a wonderful
be hustling.
One. Yeah.
And that's coming from the highest echelons of a very big company. Always be hustling, everybody.
And then the my favorite, my personal favorite, was just super pumped and being super mm-hmm. pumped, right? So Uber employees were evaluated on the level of super pumpedness that they brought
super
to their job.
Super pumpedness.
Yes, the noun, super pumpedness, which I guess roughly translated to like the zeal and energy you brought into bringing down the taxi industry or whatever.
But okay.
It was
all right.
Just, you know, I remember he unveiled these at a $25 million corporate retreat in 2015 in Las Vegas, where Beyonce was the guest of honor playing a music show for them.
Yeah, that's one of the craziest scenes that you illustrate in the course of the book. It's pretty unreal.
It's like a cartoon. And that's the employees in the audience were just like, is this guy for real?
Right.
We like, are these values like, or is this a joke? Is this just an elaborate joke? But it was like what I wanted to get at in the book is like, this is all... It's kind of too strange to be fiction, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's real, and this is kind of how some people think out here. You know?
Right. And, well, that is a mentality that is important for Uber's success and understanding where they came from, because at every step of the way, there are entrenched interests that they're running up against. There's mm-hmm. the taxi industry. There's local municipalities that don't necessarily want Uber to be there, and... Yeah. In order to get past that, you can see why they would want something like being super pumped to get past it.
Yes. I completely, like, one could argue you kind of needed to fire up your mm-hmm. troops or whatever if you're taking on some of the toughest entrenched industries, taxi lobbyists, you know, governments, taxi operators. Like, these are not people that are messing around. They are tough, right?
Yeah.
So you need troops that are fired up.
And it kind of speaks to me for this double-edged sword of this entire period in Silicon Valley, just in the sense that I get it. I get the appeal. You know,
sure.
if I were born with a slightly more analytical, techier sort of brain, I could totally see myself as a tech bro. I see the allure of these things.
I love that. It's very self-aware. I like it.
Well, I do my best. I do what I can. And, you know, if... Because what they're selling is rapid growth. They're selling solving people's problems. They're selling making the world a better place and making a buck and having a good time all at the same time. Mm. And for a long time, the argument of that held sway for a lot of people. And it took massive scandals like this. It took the 2016 election in the case of Facebook.
Yeah.
It really took a lot of big world events to make that argument seem less appealing to people.
Well, I mean, here's the sort of problem here slash, you know, it's thornier than just like tech is bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like when I wrote this book, I mean, I've always been pretty hard on Uber in my like reporting for the Times, but I think, you know, I think people that join some of these companies, like part of it is sure they want to get loaded and like this is where salaries are and you can be a partying bro. And then there are also people who do actually believe in the mission, you know, like that, like people at Facebook do believe that connecting the world is going to be a net positive thing, or they're bringing internet to people who wouldn't have otherwise had it, which could bring more opportunity online. Perhaps they can create these online businesses that they wouldn't have had before. In the case of Uber, I think the biggest proponents inside of the company believe that, look, if you want to, I think the phrase they use is ignite opportunity for people who want to drive on their own time and set their own schedule, we can sort of offer this for them, and we can do it at a massive scale. And they aren't wrong that all the sort of laws that were around how transportation worked before, how taxis operate, and how local governments sort of like work in tandem with them were designed really to protect the incumbents, right? So to some degree, I think you kind of have to, you already are the underdog when you're going up against these companies, and you have to sort of look at it as a fight depending on the industry you're breaking into. And I think perhaps transportation is like one of the most difficult industries to break into at all.
Mm. Let's talk about another theme of Uber and many other companies around this time is the worship of the founder.
Yeah.
And Travis Kalanick certainly leaned into that to a great extent. You list all the myriad ways in which he was extremely competitive, up to and including Wii tennis. He was apparently, as you write in the book, one of the top Wii tennis players in the entire world.
Yep.
What is this worship of the founder, and how did that play into how Travis Kalanick ran this country?
Yeah.
Company, excuse me.
Well, it basically was a company. No. I think there's a real obsession around, in the book I call it the cult of the founder, right? Mm-hmm. A founder is a person who starts a company. In the Valley, I think there's probably no greater honor than to start your own company, right? And it becomes something different than, people have been starting small businesses forever, right? That's just how people come to America and start their business, right? And you can grow it into a big thing. And I think that is admirable in its own right. I think it takes on some different quality here in the Valley that becomes more grandiose. And perhaps Steve Jobs was like the sort of ultimate example of like the ultimate founder, right? He has this like very showmanship like quality. He's not just creating cell phones. He's creating a dent in the universe, right? He's trying to change how all of society works. And, that rhetoric can actually be true some of the time. I would argue that the iPhone is very much a revolutionary device. We now, almost a significant portion of the world carries a $1,000 computer in their pocket for 18 hours a day and are always connected. So but I think that kind of got internalized on this new generation of, let's say, 20 to something to 30 somethings, in the post-bubble, post-dot-com era, where, the founder suddenly becomes like the end-all be-all, and their knowledge is very, is crucial, and they sort of have this divine authority almost to behave how they will.
Mm-hmm.
And in the best case scenario, I think you might get, let's say, a Jobs or a Zuckerberg who build these huge companies and largely have been successful, although you can take umbrage with the repercussions of that, especially in Facebook's case. And then in the worst case scenario, I think you have something like Uber, which is sort of like this breeding ground for Thomas Hobbes's version of survival in the real world mixed with Wolf of Wall Street, basically.
Right. Well, and even the most benign leader in the world, when it is this unfettered, completely unconstrained mentality that they have and this belief that the rules don't apply to me, excesses become inevitable at a certain point. I was telling you before we turned these microphones on, I lived in Taiwan for about 5 years, and their rollout into Uber's rollout into Taiwan was incredibly disruptive. And they got off on the wrong foot with the local lawmakers may have been willing to find some accommodation, but they just, boom, right out of the gate, they were breaking all the rules. They were trying to get in as quickly and as fastly as possible. And the question that I had for the people, the executives at Uber over in Taiwan was, I get some of the arguments that you're making. I get why the taxi industry here is inefficient. But essentially what you're asking people to do is to vest you with the authority to reconstitute this industry. And given all of your conduct so far, why would anybody want to give you that authority?
That's exactly. And this is the sort of ego. It's like a mix of ego and a messiah complex that founders and I think companies come in with that can sometimes work, sometimes be off-putting, sometimes a mixture of both, right? They're convinced that they are acting in the spirit of progress, that innovation is innovation and therefore progress are defined by positivity, right? This is, we have a better way, so therefore this is going to be a good thing.
There's no negative innovation.
Exactly, right. Being innovative is like a by default a positive thing. There are merits to that approach of sort of bulldozing ahead. One could argue that, look, Uber is ubiquitous around the entire world right now, and they might not have been polite in how they pushed their way in, but they still exist. And on the other hand, maybe you can attract flies better with honey or something, maybe eventually that approach started working against them. And I think, maybe their blitzkriegs into local governments worked for a while until it didn't, until they started realizing, hey, you are not the law, right? Just because you have invented this thing, which has some benefits, doesn't mean the laws don't apply to you anymore.
Hmm. Want to make a quick reminder to our listeners that you are listening to KCBS In Depth. I'm Keith Menconi, and this is our weekly deep dive into some of the events and trends shaping life here in the Bay Area. Today, we're digging into the history of ride-hailing tech giant Uber with Mike Isaac, author of the new book, Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber. And let's turn to one of the really, I think, darkest facets of the last couple of years at Uber. That is the revelations of sexism and how women employees were treated at the company. You mentioned Susan Fowler a couple minutes ago, who brought to light many of these problems. Tell us a little bit about what we learned based on Susan Fowler's blog post and what we learned later, and how that level of sexism was allowed to exist within this company.
Yeah, so if you remember back to 2017, early 2017, when Susan wrote her post, this was pre-Me Too movement, or really pre, like, the crux of the Me Too movement when the Weinstein allegations came out later that year.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, like, look, I think Silicon Valley as a whole is largely defined by young, often white, upper middle class males that have kind of defined the culture within, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's always been a difficult place for women or people of color to, like, break into, and that's been a thread that's been there. Uber, again, kind of represented, like, the most crystallized version of this,
mm-hmm.
right? Where I think Travis, as an upwardly mobile white male founder, kind of hired a bunch of folks in his same vein and, like, often with a sort of fratty mentality. And really the culture was, you were basically rewarded for if you made your numbers and if you were able to grow your section of the business, while any deficiencies you might have had, whether in some cases it was threatening subordinates with a baseball bat or, you know, throwing a coffee mug at another employee's head, or just rampant harassment, whether it was verbal or sexual harassment of employees beneath you, they kind of turn their head the other way,
mm-hmm.
As long as the business was running smoothly.
And that's how we get to a place where Susan Fowler is trying to run up the chain about this complaint to HR, and HR is saying the guy you're complaining about is making his numbers.
Yeah, and like that, you know, basically just sort of turn the other cheek or turn their head away from finding it. And so Susan Fowler, she ends up leaving the company. She's just tired of it. She's tired of being sort of cast aside or at least mistreated, and then decides to write this couple thousand word blog post that just detailed a real, like, sordid, you know, history at this company. And it struck a note. For whatever reason, at that moment, people in the Valley, people in technology, people across the U.S. really were ready to hear it. And it just, that was the beginning of the end for Travis's reign, I think.
Wow. Yeah. And it clearly unleashed a lot of other revelations as well. Let's get to perhaps a slightly more philosophical question here, if we could.
Yeah.
That is, you know, we're talking about the way that Silicon Valley shaped up over the last 10 years or so. And you mentioned a second ago that a lot of people see innovation as inevitable. If we didn't do it, some other guy would have.
Mm-hmm.
But is the way that that innovation was carried out, is the way that these companies and Uber in particular were constituted, was that inevitable based on the kinds of businesses that they were making?
Yeah.
Or does it come about because of the particular sorts of people that ended up at the top? Is the fact that Travis Kalanick was Travis Kalanick, is that really pivotal here?
I think this is a question that haunts people that are even at Uber now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, could Uber have been built without a Travis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you build a company without being a jerk, a great company, right?
Yeah.
Or is it sort of endemic to the personality complex of every great founder, you know? I mean, people have a lot of complicated feelings around Steve Jobs right now, you know, even if they worship him. On the other hand, he was perhaps not always the most nice person to everyone, right? People definitely, even sources that I talked to who admired Kalanick at one time, also have really fraught feelings around the guy. And just, you know, some people are like, well, he's a sociopath, or he's whatever, he's just delusional. And so I think there's probably something to the idea that, like, people with these such intense personalities or such a drive to just throw out every rule in the service of some greater thing that they see as important. There's probably something to that personality type. I don't think you necessarily have to just completely trample over the law to law or existing orders to create new things. I think that comes in time. But I guess the question for Uber people is at least ride sharing was probably going to come no matter what.
Right.
Is it? It's just a question of would Uber have been as big and as Uber-y as it is without Kalanick? And I don't think so. I think it would have probably been a different looking company over time. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, given that there is some of that malleability there are different ways to try to bring these new industries out into the world.
Yep.
Do you think in a post-2017 world where we've had some kind of a reckoning with the state of Silicon Valley, where it does seem to be the case that people are not quite as wide-eyed? These tech companies are getting much more critical coverage than they used to get.
That's right.
Do you think that we're in a different Silicon Valley now? Have things changed?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Like, so in the book, I talk about this key moment. I think it was really around the presidential election of Donald Trump. And I think in the Valley, you know, like, of course, California is not fully blue. There's a lot of, you know, red pockets and whatever. But in the Valley, it's very, you know, often like left leaning sort of tech workers and residents. And I think it was a real wake up call for, OK, well, you know, it was a shock on in the system of a lot of people. And I think almost immediately after Trump was elected, these stories started coming out. Well, you know, Facebook influenced the election, or Russia is messing with people by spreading disinformation, or drivers are forced to live in their cars or use a bathroom on the street because they can't afford a living wage because these companies are exploiting them. And this real, I use that moment as like a crystallization point for the a sort of wake-up call to people that progress is not just a unilateral thing, right? There are side effects that each of these companies create. And while I think there can be positive attributes of creating companies and moving in one direction, we also have to recognize the secondary effects of that and grapple with them, right? And I think it's just a more realistic view of looking at tech. I think probably right now we're in a very sort of hypercritical phase, and we're probably going to come out of that the pendulum is going to swing back towards something in the middle, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I think coverage kind of goes in waves like that, and this is probably an extreme pullback from years of probably not going hard enough on tech.
Mm. All right. Well, it's a story that's clearly still unfolding. But if you want to get a better handle on what's happening now, this is definitely a 10-year period or so that's well worth digging into in more depth. And you can find more depth in the book that we've been talking about all this way. It is Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber. Its author joining us in studio has been Mike Isaac. Mike Isaac, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me. This was fun.
Remember, you can listen to past episodes of KCBS In-Depth online at kcbsradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In-Depth, I'm Keith Menconi. We'll see you next time.
You've just heard KCBS In-Depth, a news interview program for All News 740 and FM 106.9 KCBS.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.